The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada and is supported by the generous donations of our listeners. If you would like to partner with us in this ministry, please go to apologeticscanada.com.
In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to be registered, each to his own town. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. And while they were there, the time came for her to give birth. And she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling cloths and laid him in a manger, because there was no place for them in the inn. And in the same region there were shepherds out in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And an angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were filled with great fear. And the angel said to them, "Fear not, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy that will be for all the people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord. And this will be a sign for you. You will find a baby wrapped in swaddling cloths and lying in a manger." And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace among those with whom he is pleased." When the angels went away from them into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, "Let us go over to Bethlehem and see this thing that has happened, which the Lord has made known to us." And they went with haste and found Mary and Joseph and the baby lying in a manger. And when they saw it, they made known the saying that had been told them concerning this child. And all who heard it wondered at what the shepherds told them. But Mary treasured up all these things, pondering them in her heart. And the shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all they had heard and seen, as it had been told them. And at the end of 8 days, when he was circumcised, he was called Jesus, the name given by the angel before he was conceived in the womb. Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
Just before we get
and
into
that
things.
That is the Christmas story.
That is the Christmas story. Probably the, I would say the one out of Luke is probably the more popular one, the more well-known one.
Yeah.
Than the one from Matthew, although the story of the children being slain and the flight to Egypt is pretty popular too. But
Those introductory words there, "in those days, a decree." That's all I remember from my childhood, right? Like hearing that story and
It brings back memories for sure.
Yeah. Let's come back to that in just a moment, but a couple of quick announcements for you. It's December. In about a week's time now, our ticket price for the conference will go up. So if you want to take advantage of the super early bird pricing, now is the time to get your tickets. The price goes up on December 15th, so make sure you do that.
Great Christmas present idea.
Yep. Give the gift of learning to those that you love. And then we're actually running the Thinking Series online course again for the winter semester. So it starts again in January. I'll have all of the details up soon in terms of exactly on what date it starts and everything. So if you're interested, or if you know somebody who's interested, make sure you sign up.
Do it for fun or credit.
Yep. All right.
Let's get into the Christmas story here. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I find fascinating, I mean, we already started to talk about it, we just can't help ourselves. Mm. But one of the things that I find fascinating about the Christmas story is that Christmas is wrapped up in a myth. And particularly, it's wrapped up in the myth of Santa Claus. And so it's interesting that we ask our kids to do two things simultaneously, don't we? To hold to one story, one narrative that's completely far-fetched of a fat man in a crushed red velvet suit flying around with reindeer.
Mm. But it's such a great story.
invading your house with Christmas presents while you're sleeping.
That's creepy.
Yeah, placing them under your Christmas tree.
All kinds of creepy there, yeah.
Right? And then we tell them another story of this divine individual that was both God and man and came to rescue you from your sins, to defeat death on your behalf. And we ask them to hold both of these stories at the same time. It's interesting. Have you guys ever heard of this news article from September 21st, 1897, called Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus?
I think I've heard that.
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
Weren't you alive in 1897?
Wow.
That's harsh, man.
When Terry was born, the Earth's crust was cooling down.
Oh, that felt good. You know, it creeps me out when I meet people that were born in 1997. I was just graduating from high school.
Mm.
Okay. It says, Dear editor, I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says, if you see it in the sun, the newspaper, it is so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus or not? And then this is what the paper writes back. And actually, before I read that, I just got to ask you, in your house, were you taught that Santa Claus was real or not real?
In my house, it was a bit different, maybe. Like, we all knew that Santa Claus wasn't real. I guess part of it was because, well, you know, this is a Western thing, right? And we're Korean, and it's whatever. It's so we grew up knowing that this wasn't real, but we pretended anyway.
I mean, how is Christmas celebrated in Korea?
Christmas in Korea is, at least back when I was living there still, it was more about spending time with your romantic partner. Here, it's a lot more of a family thing. There, it's a lot more of a romantic thing.
Interesting. In what sense is it a romantic thing?
Well, it's kind of like almost like another Valentine's Day for December. That's what it kind of comes down to. Of course, you know, you get gifts for your family and things like that too, but the emphasis seems to be more on your romantic partner than on your family.
Interesting. On an interesting side note, and I mean a side note, if any of you watch Adventure Time, which is a cartoon that my kids seem to enjoy, Lady Rainicorn speaks Korean. And so I'm incredibly jealous that Steve Kim can understand Lady Rainicorn.
So just the kids like this show, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I may enjoy it. Terry, what about in your house?
You know, growing up, we did celebrate lots of presents, you know, the Christmas thing was always there, but I don't remember at all the story about Santa Claus. I was thinking about that last night, and there just wasn't any.
So your parents didn't talk about Santa at all?
Not that I remember. I mean, like, I'm thinking back to like when I was 6 or 7, this very big Christmas, and like it just wasn't there that I remember. I don't remember that story. I mean, I knew it was there, but it wasn't like, you know.
Interestingly enough, in my house, both stories were told. Santa Claus was told that as being real. And by the way, one of the things I find interesting with kids is I find most kids don't believe that Santa Claus is real. I know that I, as a kid, didn't believe that Santa Claus was real. I mean, the story sounded far-fetched.
Yeah.
But it really depends upon the parent's willingness to press the issue.
Right.
And comes down, interestingly, to a trust question. Because I said to my parents, no, that's ridiculous. To which I said, no, it's true. And then on my parents being somebody that I trusted, you know, I said, okay, I guess Santa Claus is real.
I guess that's where it was for me. They didn't push it, right? It was there.
Right.
But it wasn't pushed. I really don't remember thinking that he was real or anything like that. But
because my kids have never gone, I believe that Santa Claus is, you know, I believe the Santa story. You know, as soon as they heard it, they're like, okay, that sounds crazy. And then they look at you and say, Dad, is it real? Yeah. You know, and then you got to make a decision. Yeah. You know, am I going to push this or not? And so I told my kids, well, no. And then I told them, you know, about Saint Nick and that whole thing. Now, it was interesting for me as a kid going, I think something's up here. I think this fat guy in a crushed red velvet suit might not be real flying around with reindeer. So I decided to test my hypothesis, and I sent a letter off to Santa Claus in the North Pole. And I asked for very specific things that weren't very expensive so that I had a good chance of getting these things so that I could determine
starting
whether or
low.
Not. Yeah. So I figured, you know, Santa gets this. It's a humble request and allows me to verify whether or not he's real. And that Christmas, I got everything on that list.
Wow.
And as I'm opening each present, I'm thinking to myself, I should have asked for more expensive stuff, man. Like, well, it ends up that as great as my hypothesis was, that the mistake I made was not putting a stamp on the envelope that my mom found in the mailbox and went and continued to play this ruse. But then that year she told me Santa's not real and I wept bitterly. Back to Virginia. This is what the newspaper wrote to her. They said, Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant in his intellect, as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole of truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist. And you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there was no Santa Claus. It would be as dreary as if there was no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. And this, I'll stop there, but it continues to go on in this way.
Yeah. It sounds so much like what something C.S. Lewis would say. You know what I mean?
Like his argument from myth?
Yeah, it sounds a lot like something, like it's his language almost. It's very reminiscent of that.
I can appreciate that. I think that there would be clearly a difference here in that, and this is where I wanted to go with this, or the direction I wanted to take this conversation. Have you ever watched a movie that you hear this story that is so incredible and so uplifting that you're thinking to yourself, wow, this is amazing. And then at the end of the movie, you see, based on a true story. You know, and then it takes everything up one more notch. I mean, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that you could make the argument that something that exists in reality is better than something that does not exist in reality.
Mm-hmm. That's a great end for the ontological argument too, like existence and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, that was exactly my reaction when I watched something like, I don't know if you've heard of this movie, Ip Man.
Yeah.
And
that's a great kung fu movie.
Yeah. So, you know, me geeking out, right, watching this movie, it turns out it was based on Ip Man was actually a living figure, like Bruce Lee's teacher kind of thing. And it was based on some of his stories.
Right. And then Bruce Lee, you know, an actor representing Bruce Lee, you know, makes some cameos, which is just fantastic.
Yeah.
Because if you're a Bruce Lee fan, you geek out something terrible. But yeah, you're absolutely right. There's that factor where, oh man, this is based on a true story and represents reality that takes this, you know, to a whole nother level. And so, because it's interesting, my mom once said this to me. I don't know if you've ever heard somebody say something like this. And I knew more where my mom was coming from. But she said, even if I find out Christianity is not true, she said, I'm still going to be a Christian. Hmm. And what she was saying was, the story is so wonderful and it's done so much in my life, I would still hold to it even if I found it wasn't true. And I remember thinking in my mind, something not quite right there.
Yeah. In fact, it wasn't that Paul's point when he was talking about the resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15, right? If there's no resurrection of the dead, then Jesus didn't rise from the dead and we're still in our sins and we're men most to be pitied.
Yeah, and to push back to C.S. Lewis would say, this then isn't a good story. This, in fact, is a horrible story.
Right. Gives you false hope kind of thing?
Yeah,
right.
It gives you false hope. And then who even is this Jesus that's claiming to be the Son of God?
Right.
He has a article in one of his books called Myth Became Fact, right? That's how he describes all these other myths that could be, Jesus' story could be amongst all these. But in the end, there's some historical stuff.
Oh, I think that's such an important point of our culture. I personally think the superhero stories that we tell are a retelling of the cosmic story that is the incarnation. And it is the original superhero story.
And other stories too, like say the Disney stories, like the princess stories. Like if you think about it, I remember Clay Jones making that point. Like if you look at all of these things, you have this a girl who is down and out, who gets rescued by a prince and gets married and has this, you know, happily ever after kind of a life, right? If the gospel story sounds like this story, then you've got it exactly backwards. It is these stories that sound so much like the gospel story.
That's right. And that's where I would say that my mom, God bless her, and I love my mom, but the reason she's attracted to the gospel is because it's true. You know, and because it's true, it has done amazing things in your life and is an amazing story. Mm-hmm. So then the question is that I want to look at, this being the holiday season, is the Christmas story true? I mean, is the nativity story, is it true? And is there aspects of the nativity story that we might, in fact, not have quite right?
Mm-hmm.
And does that, you know— How this is an interesting question, by the way, that Mike Lacona in his new book addresses. What's the book title? What's the title?
The book is called "Why Are There Differences in the Gospels? What We Can Learn from Ancient Biography."
And yeah, ancient biography. I would encourage you to take a look at that book. I heard Lacona speak on that book at ETS this year, and it was fantastic.
It'll be released in January.
Oh, it's not out quite yet.
Not quite yet.
Okay. So you can't get it as a Christmas present for someone, but it's fantastic in that it's talking about how stories were told in antiquity, and particularly that we see that different aspects of the nativity are highlighted in different gospels. Now, Mark just doesn't even reference it at all.
No.
John strictly references the divinity aspect of the incarnation. The Word became flesh. But then you get in Matthew and Luke, you get the human story, the human divine story of the nativity that's fleshed out, and they're slightly different.
Right. But what kind of stories did you guys grow up with, right, within the church being told to us? It seemed to be very dreamy almost. You know what I mean? Like there was certain facts that were not—
I would call it romanticized.
Romanticized, yeah. Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and there were certain things that were reinforced that may not be historically all that accurate, right? Because I remember growing up in the Roman Catholic Church, we always had this nativity scene right in the church, like inside the chapel, in the sanctuary. And it's your typical nativity scene, right? You have the Holy Family with this wooden structure, barn kind of a thing, with all these animals, and the three wise men are there.
Yeah. It's all always that kind there of stuff. To make us feel good almost, right? Like there's this scene that we see in our minds that—
Well, I would push back though a little bit on that, and I would say, yeah, we romanticize it to make us feel good, but I also think that we have to appreciate, and I think this is one of the things Lacona gets at as well, that when you tell a story, you got to pick and choose which aspects you're going to highlight, not highlight,
exactly.
And how long that story is going to be. And sometimes you got to truncate things, like in a nativity scene, the wise men probably didn't show up for 2 years or so on the scene. So they probably weren't there, but we put them in there to truncate the story.
Right. Because their story is just as much a part of this story, right? There is, because their whole point of the travel is that there's this newborn king of Israel, right? Mm-hmm. So the purpose of their trip was to see the king that has been born. That was the whole point.
Right.
And so—
But there's still some misinformation.
That's right.
Right? Some misinformation.
Or what we would consider misinformation. I actually had a discussion over something like this with an agnostic who is very much a skeptic of the reliability of the Gospels and things like that. And his point is this actually compromises the integrity of the Gospels as historical records, to which I said, no, it doesn't. If you were to actually accuse Luke of inaccuracies and things like that, he would have been surprised because this was part of the writing convention of the day. This was accepted.
And that's Lacona's point in his newest book,
right?
Of ancient biography. But interestingly enough, that's how we write stories even today.
Right.
There's just certain limitations on how you tell the story. But that being said, really what we're getting at is what's being highlighted, what's not being highlighted. The accuracy, though, is there. There's nothing in what Luke is saying that is not accurate to the story of what took place. What I'm getting at is how he's highlighting what did take place. But before we get into Luke's accuracy, I did want to mention one aspect just of cultural inaccuracy. And that is one of the real challenges that we find when we come to the Bible is we tend to read it as a 21st century document.
Exactly.
And when we do that, we will impose things on it, such as there was no room in the inn.
Uh-huh.
And so what you'll find often with these nativity scenes is a cave, for example, or in some sort of stable. But I want to push back, and I want to make the argument that and most archaeologists, most historians would hold to this, that when you look at what's being talked about as no room in the inn, is a different – now, that we find that in Luke chapter 2, verse 7.
Right.
That word for inn is translated in Mark chapter 14, verse 14, as guest room.
Yeah.
And this is where the Passover takes place in Mark chapter 14.
Kataluma is the Greek word for it.
That's right. And now if Luke wanted to use, though, the word for inn, like we're going to go to Motel 6 and there's just no room, he uses that word in Luke chapter 10 and when he tells the parable of the Good Samaritan, in which the Good Samaritan takes him to an inn. And Luke now uses a different word, pandahehon.
Yeah.
And this word represents, you know, a place that you would go in which you pay for a room. Now, what we get then, the idea where Mary and Joseph would have gone is a house. And it may have been even a relative's house. I would argue probably was a relative's house.
Yeah.
And there were probably a lot of people there because of the census. And there was no room in this guest room. It can also be translated dining room. This would have been an open room. And I've been to rooms like this, by the way. I've stayed in a house like this in Nepal. They still build houses like this. And the way they're built is they're built to have 2 to 3 stories. The first story is where you keep the first floor, if you will, is where you keep your animals. And there's a couple reasons for that. You keep your animals in there to keep them safe, especially at night. You keep your animals in there to keep them warm, and it also helps to keep you warm. And it's also way easier to take care of them and requires less natural resources. Right. And then your second floor would be where you'd do cooking. You would be having people sleep there. And then on your third floor, if you had a third floor, or you'd use the roof, you would have people sleeping there as well. Uh-huh. And so the idea then, what you get is what the nativity scene actually most likely looked like was them being, Mary and Joseph being in that first floor where the animals were kept. And that because there was no room in the upper room, or in the guest room, that they needed to sleep where the animals were.
The objection often is that Bethlehem wasn't on a major trading route or anything like that. So it's unlikely that you will have an inn, like pandahehon, kind of an inn where you actually pay money to rent a room. So where Luke says, you know, there was no room at the inn, or at least that's how it's translated typically, they would say, no, this is fictitious then. But that's, he's actually using a different word to make the distinction.
Now, I don't have a problem with people using the cave, or if you got your nativity scene at home and it's not representing, you know, that there wasn't a guest room and that they were in the bottom floor of a house. I don't think that destroys anything of the story.
No. And that's the critical thing, right? And we look at some of these details and we have this idea in our minds, especially with that agnostic guy that I was talking about. If there is just even that one what he would call a mistake or an error or something like that, all of a sudden, this whole story is thrown into question. And that just boggles my mind.
Well, I would push even more than that, because what I find is that the story is put into question from the very beginning. That's the default. And then it's not, so it's constantly being held in question. It's not, it's like guilty until proven innocent when it comes to the Gospels. It's interesting because historians don't do this with other documents. But when it comes specifically to the Gospels, you see this, you know, guilty till proven innocent. And you often see that because, and I often hear this from Christians that will say, well, do we have any other evidence outside of the Gospels? And my question is, what's wrong with the Gospels?
Yeah. In fact, that's what skeptical scholars do. Like if you've if you're familiar with Gary Habermas's minimal facts approach, that's exactly what he'll say. Well, if I don't use the Gospels, guess who's going to use the Gospels? It's the skeptics. They're going to use it because they understand that even without approaching it as the inspired word of God, these are reliable historical records for the life of Jesus, or at least these are the best records that we have of him.
And I want to talk about that. Are these reliable records for the life of Jesus? Often we hear that, you know, is pushed forward this idea that Jesus didn't exist or all of this was just a myth. You know, what kind of evidence do we have that now I want to just really hone in here. What kind of evidence do we have that the nativity scene is actually correct, that Luke is historically accurate?
In fact, it's often alleged that it's not accurate because of the way he describes the census or who was the governor of Syria at what time, that sort of thing. So often this story from Luke is often thrown into question because of its alleged historical inaccuracies.
So we're going to get into that. The first thing I want to get into, and I'm sure people have heard us talk about before, is that historians don't doubt whether or not Jesus existed. Now, we have brought up the fact that you can find two of them currently of all historians that are writing on the subject. You can find two that will doubt Jesus' existence.
And by that,
Richard
we mean
Carrier
like,
being one of them.
Yeah, but and by that we mean like people that actually have advanced degrees in this area, not just somebody like
right.
a 16-year-old kid blogging. That's not what we're talking about.
Right. And now Bart Ehrman, who was a Christian and no longer is, he left the faith in his book, The Problem of Pain. He writes that he left the faith over evil and suffering. But he wrote a book in annoyance of the mythicist argument that Jesus didn't exist. And he says this. He says, there are several points on which virtually all scholars of antiquity agree. Jesus was a Jewish man known to be a preacher and teacher who was crucified, a Roman form of execution, in Jerusalem during the reign of the Roman Emperor Tiberius when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea. Even though this is the view of nearly every trained scholar on the planet, it is not the view of a group of writers who are usually labeled and often label themselves mythicists. So just to deal with right off the get-go, Jesus was a historical figure, and vast majority of historians hold that to be true. This idea that Jesus was a myth and the whole nativity scene being a myth, you do not see respectable scholars holding to that. And in fact, when you get into and read more about the mythicists, their stuff is ridiculous.
There was an interesting little go back and forth between Gary Habermas and Richard Carrier on a podcast called Unbelievable. So if you want to hear a little bit more about that, there's some interesting dialogue going on there between those two.
Yeah, and we also have up online, I think we have a video up online of the Zeitgeist myth.
Right, yeah. I actually wrote a paper on that, and I've addressed this issue before, like touched on Zeitgeist briefly, yep. So I can share that again.
Yeah, so we don't have time to get into that now because I want to get into the nativity, but that has been dealt with, and if you want more information, you can go there.
Okay, we're going to have to wrap up there because we're out of time, but we'll come back next week with part two of this episode. Thank you for listening. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada. See you next week.